Well, it is my great pleasure this week to meet for the second time, actually the third time, Maggie Webster. And of course, we've been doing a lot of TV filming over the last few months. But do you want to say a little bit, Maggie, about where you're based?
I'm based in Preston. That's where I live. But I work in Edgehill University in Ormskirk, which is about 40 minutes from Liverpool and about 50 minutes from Manchester, both ways.
Yeah. And I discovered, of course, when I met you for the filming back in the autumn, that we have a Lampeter connection.
Yes, I did my PhD in Lampeter. So I joined Lampeter in 2013 to do my PhD with Professor Gary Bunt and Professor Bettina Schmidt in the Trinity and Religious and Islamic Studies sort of department. And that took me about eight years. So I was there part time.
And the work, of course, was on witchcraft. Is that right?
Yeah, my PhD is about how people become witches through social media. So I explored Facebook. TikTok wasn't around then. I'm looking at TikTok now. But Facebook, Instagram, Pinterest, YouTube, and Twitter, and how people who self-identify as a witch explore these spaces and inhabit them, basically, to find out or confirm who they are as a in terms of a faith identity and witchcraft and witches, and how they create themselves through these platforms and these communities of practice. It was really fascinating. I also interviewed 13 witches, which just happened to be a number that I ended with. Miraculously, not because I chose. That's when it all dried up. You know, when you keep asking for people to come and volunteer, it ended at 13. I thought, that's quite ironic, you know, coven.
Actually, it's funny and it's funny you say that, because we were doing some filming in Birmingham just before Christmas, asking people about Christmas, and they were not giving the answers I was expecting, because I do work in this area. And what was funny is that we really struggled to get people to speak. But then suddenly a group, I think it was actually maybe 14, so we may have had like up to 14 if we were lucky that whole day, and suddenly these 14 girls who were going out clearly on a night out,
yeah,
and they were like, oh, there's a TV camera here. So, and they got really sort of excited. Hey, can we be on TV? And we were thinking, oh, this is a disaster, you know, we don't want this. But we thought, okay, maybe we should just do it and then they'll go. Yeah. They were fantastic. They all played off each other. They gave the best piece. They were all sort of, you know, answering the questions, agreeing with each other, being really respectful, you know, not, you know, taking it all very seriously. So it just goes to show sometimes that, you know, you spend a whole day looking for individuals to do this, and then literally 14 in that case, or 13, similar to what you were saying, come along at once.
Yeah, I know. And it's just one of those things, isn't it? You go, okay, I'll stop there.
Yeah.
It's nice to talk to people and find out what they think and believe. I find it fascinating. Yeah. So I would have loved to have been in the part of that interview you just did.
That'd be absolutely. Funny. Well, you've done another one where it's literally all about you and your daughter. But do you want to just say a little bit about the way that worked? Because in interviewing witches, did you find that a lot of them were really happy to talk about, maybe to quell misconceptions, or were some of them like, oh, this is really personal, and they felt maybe they really needed you to anonymize, as you would have done anyway, their data?
Yeah. It's a mixture, to be honest. When I asked them, you know, how long they've been, or how'd they come to witches and witchcraft, some of them, so they range from the ages of 20 to 70. So it's quite a nice broad age. And there was 11 women and 2 men. And the people in their teen or in the early 20s, they were exploring, they were out on Twitter and Facebook, Instagram, they were out saying, I am a witch, that's fine. They were in a pagan societies, and that was grand. The people in the 30s and 40s were a little bit more reticent. So they hadn't come out to their family. One person had, she was active as a Wiccan rather, and she is now a high priestess. So she's fabulous. But she was very much more, oh yeah, I'm out there, but I don't push it too much. But, you know, I don't tell people exactly what I'm doing, because it's supposed to be quiet and secret. Whereas other the 40s were saying, well, no, I look, you know, normal. I'm middle-aged. I wear, you know, don't wear gothic stuff. And so I don't share too much of my spirituality on social media. But those who know me, know me. And then the people, then there was a young man who was in his 30s, or late 20s, he'd been in his 30s now. And he was all very nature-based, and he explored so many different paths. So he was Wiccan at one point, Druid at one point, Shaman at one point, and blended the whole lot together. And that's how he uses the umbrella term of witch. And he didn't identify, he didn't say, I am a witch. He would just say, oh, yeah, I'm nature-based to other people. But people sort of knew he was, commas, pagan. And then there's this one girl who were at work would not at all say anything. And she didn't want, there's two of them actually, didn't want to say that the word witch. They felt a little uncomfortable with that term because of the connotations. But they realized that they had practices that were related to it. And that was quite interesting. And then the final person who is 70 since birth out there. Completely. His whole, I went to his house, it's fabulous. And it was so stereotypically a witch. He was all this wizard looking sort of man, big beard, Merlin type. And I went to his house and he had something like seven cats, all black. And he had Wiccan symbols all over the place and goddesses and the pan and a very phallic symbols. And I'm thinking, okay, you can so tell that he's a witch. So it was mixed, depending on, but I think a lot of people now I'm talking to use the term because they want to fight back against any of the stereotype and the negative connotation of the word.
Yeah. And it's funny, isn't it? Because 30 odd years ago, I can imagine that maybe you couldn't have done that sort of research, or at least you couldn't have done it in the, well, obviously not least because social media wasn't there, but also in terms of how comfortable people would have been to talk about this.
Well, yeah, in the 90s, it was just starting to come out the broom closet, I suppose, where there was a magazine in 1990, I think it was. And this magazine was, it was Spirit and Destiny magazine, and it was the first of its kind to talk about alternate spiritualities, so pagan, but also nature-based religions, etc., and tarot. And it was becoming popular, so it then became a bit more accepted. And then there was films, so The Craft, Practical Magic, Bewitched was on TV for ages, but then it became a resurgence. Sabrina Teenage Witch was 80s and 90s. So it became, yeah, it was a bit fun, but it was also becoming like a little bit more norm. And there was also Charmed, the series. So these things came along. So in the, you could, so there's a little bit of research going on about how people were, how this growth of spirituality and the witch was becoming popularized. But yeah, I think finding people was very hard because people were quiet and silent. They still are. It's very hard to find a coven or to find a group of people. You can find them online, but if you're wanting to find in-person places, you really have to start searching.
Yeah. I guess in your case, the fact that you made this a project as well, a PhD project, must have given you, emboldened you in a way, because it's like, well, you've got almost like the justification, you know, in talking about it, because you have a platform for doing that academically. I'm guessing that might have worked. I mean, I find that with a lot of my projects, if I turn my interests, sometimes quite quirky interests about radio or whatever, or film, obviously, into academic projects, then suddenly, of course, you know, you have to talk about it, and it suddenly brings out this confidence that maybe you otherwise wouldn't have. You wouldn't have the sort of the platform to do that.
No, I think what was interesting about my choice of this one was I work as a university lecturer, and I had a master's, but I didn't have a PhD. And there was a push as in education. So your career became your qualifications of what you needed because of teacher training. But there was a push towards staff doing PhDs. And I was like, oh, it's elitist. I'm not doing it. I think, you know, you shouldn't have to have a PhD, blah, blah, blah. And then I said, well, if I am going to do it, it's very much me, very stubborn. I'm going to do it on what I'm interested in. And although I like education, I'm not that interested in it. Well, I am to a point, but, you know, not like how do you train teachers? So I basically said, well, I'm really interested in social media. So at the time, Second Life was growing. And this is a virtual online platform that looks a bit like the Sims game. And you create an avatar and you move around, and it was in the news and everything. And the avatar you create can fly and go to different islands and learn different things. You can have university presence, you can have book knowledge, you can have workshops, but there's also just gaming. And there's all sorts of other stuff like commerce, but there was a huge gambit of religion on there. So I was fascinated by this. So I said to my bosses that I'm going to do a PhD, but I want to do it about religion because that's my background. That's my master's and my undergraduate. So they agreed, and I was very lucky to get it funded each year, asking for funding. And as the years went on, you have to narrow it, don't you? So it's nice and broad, social media and religion, but there's been a lot doing that on the big sixes. So Christianity and Islam have been done quite a lot. And then when my supervisor said to me, what do you want to it to come out with? I said, well, I don't want a PhD about Second Life because that's short lived. But I want social media or social networking spaces and witches or pagans. I said, because that's what I'm interested in. I've been interested in since a child. So then that gave me permission to indulge and explore and find out. And then I realized that that was me and that I was destined to do this all along. And now it's opening out other doors because now I'm being asked by schools and other communities come and talk about my research to share that what a contemporary witch is. And I'm using that as a platform to demystify some of the negative, evil type of rhetoric around what a witch is.
And you're right, because if you're going to do sort of research at that kind of level, you know, it has to be something that you know, I suppose this is in a way what the podcast is about. It's like, you know, what makes you get up in the morning? What are your drivers? You know, what are the things that you want to do? And sometimes you're right. It feels sometimes like preordained, almost like, you know, you have to do this. I found that in my life sometimes. It's almost like I'm doing projects that almost like I have to do, and I'd be doing them even if I wasn't in this particular job.
Yeah, you feel that this is the way it's supposed to be. And I also know myself, I know that if I'm going to complete something, I have to be completely immersed in it. And because, you know, your work is so busy, I had to have something as a hobby. So I had to want to do this in my weekends and evenings. So it's like a hobby as well as much as a work thing. So I knew that this would keep me interested and interesting and going, and I didn't realize it would be blow my mind, to be honest. I've loved it every minute. But there's lots of things that I think you have to try, don't you? It's what you're supposed to be doing.
Yeah, and you're right, because in some professions sometimes people, and understandably so, will often sort of say, oh gosh, you know, I can't wait for my holiday or whatever. But sometimes I think, you know, it's like I need to do this, I need to do that, and often it's not being able to switch off, but it's also knowing the things to switch off from. And yeah. And sometimes, you know, the question of what is work, you know, I always joke to people sometimes that I come into work, but work is stopping me from doing my work, you know. It's like, because, you know, this, you know, yeah. We wear those multiple hats, and sometimes it all works out, but sometimes you get asked to do something that you feel is sort of stopping you from doing your sort of core.
Oh, completely. I've thought something. I want to just read this book, please.
Yeah, I know. It's like, I just want to read a book.
I ordered some books at work, and it came and onto my desk, and it was these all academic, like geeky stuff. I was like, oh my God, books. And the admin people were laughing at me because I was so excited about these books, all about witches and witchcraft. But that's another thing as well. When I was doing my PhD, as a downtime, I still like reading fiction. So I happen to read everything about witches. So any fiction about witches. And and also TV, I'd watch films about witches, because then I felt that I wasn't cheating. At least I'm doing something. I'm having a nice downtime, but I'm still working. But that's been really interesting, because since I now know loads of fiction about witches, and it's called Witch Lit now. It's a thing. And it's, and I thought, oh gosh, that's really interesting. So I am looking at writing a paper about Witch Lit and also about film. And I've done a bit, actually. I've just written a chapter about male stereotype of witches in children's film and fiction for a book that's coming out at the end of the year, I think. And that was looking at how gender stereotype is in things like Harry Potter and Sword in the Stone and fairy tale stories, because that's what the book is. And I looked at book and film. So that was quite interesting. And I had that background, which wasn't really my PhD. That was my leisure time.
Yeah. And it's funny you say that, because the first film I ever bought in the days of VHS, of course, was The Witches of Eastwick. And I was obsessed with that film. I'd be watching it sort of like once a week, and it was Jack Nicholson has always been sort of a brilliant performer, but also it's one of those films that it's sort of, I think it works because it has lots of genres going on it. It's a bit of a thriller, it's a bit of a romance, it's got the supernatural, it's obviously sort of very sort of religiously, spiritually sort of oriented as well, and you're sort of watching that, and it kind of feels it sort of, each time you watch it, there's a different sort of thread that comes out. And that was sort of, it was mind-blowing back in, well, 87, obviously, when it was made.
It's a fab film, and I think I've used that and some others to critique the female, because the thing that's interesting about that film is the women are empowered, they're strong, they get rid, but then in the end they still go back to him. Seriously? So he still has power over them at the end. So they have a child with so-called the devil is what we're supposed to assume it is. But they then, yeah, they have a little bit of control, but it's still heteronormative and it's still feminist to a point, but it's of the 80s, it's of its time. Whereas some now that are being filmed are pushing that genre a little bit more. So it is, we don't need man, it's more sisterhood, and the man isn't necessarily as prevalent nowadays. But it was quite interesting. Things like Charmed and Practical Magic, fabulous films of a similar sort of time, but they were still heteronormative and popularist and very much like you are only are full if you are in a relationship, and you're only full if you are in a long-term marriage in some cases. Like Bewitched, her whole essence was to be normal. And that normality, and not always of its time, but that normality is being married and not looking like a witch.
Do you know, it's funny you say that, because it really struck me during lockdown when I was watching, I was going back over all these films from the 90s when I was at university and loving it all. But it really struck me that all of these films I really liked, and the stuff that was sort of very early 90s especially, they were always sort of white male protagonists, often in their middle, you know, the Michael Douglas or Bill Murray Groundhog Day or Clint Eastwood, Harrison Ford. You know, it's the sort of middle-aged men, and it's there, and white middle, you know, white as well, very kind of sort of, and Michael Douglas in those, in the sort of Fatal Attraction, Basic Instinct films as well. And you sort of look at it now, and I thought, you know, at the time, I just thought, you know, that's what Hollywood was making. That's the stuff I used to watch. That those were the choices on offer. But I think it was when I saw Nomadland in 2021, when that won the Best Picture Oscar, that it suddenly struck me that sort of those films that I really liked, almost, and rightly so, couldn't be made anymore. And what you said about The Witches of Eastwick is absolutely right. It's almost as though the only way that that film about the witches could be made was to have Jack Nicholson obviously sort of doing his sort of comic shtick. And actually it kind of overpowered every other ingredient of the film.
It's really interesting. So one of the things that I've been doing with my students as well is comparing Hocus Pocus from the 90s to now, because that's been a recent one, isn't it? Last year, 2022, I think it was, came out. Fabulous, fabulous film. But the messages are really interesting, because it's very much showing how we've changed as a society, I think. In the 90s, Hocus Pocus was about the witches being evil, eating children, killing children. There was a strong male presence who was trying to help save everybody. And even though the girl was quite strong, it was still, you know, young and needing to be saved. Whereas in the most, and the witches were very much about killing and wanting to stay young. And the most recent one is much more interesting, because it's the protagonists of females, are three girls, and then the witches, and it's all about sisterhood. And that what actually saves everybody, the Sanderson sisters, as well as the three girls, is their sisterhood. And so the Sanderson sisters don't need youth. They just need family and sisterhood. And the three girls who save the day are about coming together as one, and it's sisterhood. So it's very feminist, and I love it. So even though the other one was seen as strong female characters, which it is, it's quite interesting that in 2022-23 we are trying to shake up the idea of what it means to be old woman witch, young woman witch, and femininity, which can be strong rather than needing a savior, you know, damsel in distress. It's quite interesting. Yeah. Really interesting to unpick. Love it.
You're right. And it's completely changed the way that I watch films. And the reasons I watch films and the things I got out of films 30 years ago, almost now I'm having to self-critique. And if I'm reviewing any of those films, as I was during lockdown, I was almost having to put in that that justification that I'm watching it now through the lens of 30 years later. And it's almost like, and I felt that, you know, it's almost like, why is, you know, and nobody actually said this to me, but I was almost thinking, you know, people might think, you know, why is Chris watching all these films about these white male middle-class men and their problems in their sort of, you know, it's like, fine, but it's like, those were all the films that, like, in 1993 I watched. So I was thinking one week I was watching Groundhog Day, In the Line of Fire, The Fugitive. They're all amazing films, but actually they all followed the same template. You never get away with it now, and rightly so.
Yeah, it's really interesting. And I think as well that today's audiences, I've watched a few of them with my daughter, saying, oh, this is a classic, let's watch this. And it's like, that's sexist. That's misogynist, mum. Yeah, I know. And it's really quite, yeah, but let's just look at it and let's just see it as of its time and let's have a conversation. But I do love the old films. They're great.
I mean, that's the thing, because if you grow up with these, then it's like music as well. You can't, they're critic proof. You can't, you know, I remember, you know, I grew up with a lot of stuff and we're the same age, you know, in sort of early 80s. I loved the music from that era. But, you know, my children might look at it and think, Daddy, this is weird. But you're like, well, yeah, but it's in my DNA. I can't, you know, it's part of my identity. You know, I'll hear a song, I don't know, Arthur's theme by Christopher Cross or Bucks Fizz or Shaken Stevens or something. And it takes me back to a particular time and place, primary school, etc. And I can't shake that.
No, it's well, you get a whole of that now with Eurovision starting next time. Love Eurovision, but the whole nostalgia comes out with that one. Yeah. I think I find interesting is that you're driving in the car and there might be coming a song on it. That's a modern song. And I start singing it and Tara will go, how do you know that? Because it used to be in the 80s. They're remaking it and I know the words. Yeah. And it's fab how that comes around and that kids think that you weren't invented. You didn't exist before they were born. But yeah, it does throw you back to when you were 13 or 20 or whatever. And it reminds you. And that, yeah, going back to Eurovision, that's what's going to happen next week. I love Eurovision.
And we should probably, and of course, that's taking place in Liverpool, which is not too far away from where you are. Is there a real buzz? I mean, you're right. I mean,
oh, Eurovision, massive buzz.
I grew up with all of that. We're the same age. So you probably remember as I do. I'm not sure I was allowed to stay up for all of it. But when Bucks Fizz won, I do remember Bucks Fizz winning, although I wouldn't have watched the results. I probably saw them perform earlier in the show. That was the first record I ever bought.
Really?
Making your mind up when I was eight, seven or eight.
My first record was Watership Down. How sad is that?
Well, the Art Garfunkel one.
No, it's very sad. Anyway, yeah, no, my mum and dad let me, we made a big thing of it. So we'd have high tea, which would be chocolate cake and sandwiches and sausage rolls. I loved it. On this coffee table in front of the telly. I've still got the coffee table. It's fab. So many memories. And then we would have a scorecard and we'd talk about it and give them a score. And then at the end, we would all go, Nilpois. And it was just really good fun. It's a really good memory. And then it got really crap as he got older. It wasn't that good I didn't think it was that good in the 30s and when I was in my 40s. But last year, oh my goodness, I loved it last year. Sam Ryder, absolutely amazing. And I just loved it all the way through. So I think last year was the first time I watched it properly again, and I loved it. So this year, because it's in Liverpool, all my students are talking about it, or maybe not all, quite a few. And I know some people are going to Eurovision parties. So there's a big gay vibe that's happening in the village. So there's like a lot of events happening to celebrate as a lead up to the final thing. So it's great.
It's funny how that happens, because I remember in that sort of early 80s, the Eurovision was always seen as a bit naff, a bit like, you know, the music's not very good and the whole Nilpois stuff, you know, and obviously Britain in those days actually did do fairly well. I mean, if it didn't win, it often came second. I think Michael Ball, Sonia, all that sort of stuff. But then suddenly, and I don't know when it was, I'm guessing it was sort of mid-90s, and you mentioned the gay vibe, suddenly it became ridiculously camp. I think when it was in Birmingham in 98, it would have been after Katrina and the Waves won, suddenly it became really cool, you know, to follow Eurovision. And I don't know at what point it sort of went from one to the other. And it suddenly became really kind of like the thing everybody was talking about.
Yeah, it's weird. I don't know when that happened. I know when we started not getting good, you know, getting good points in Eurovision as Britain, when it became politicised and everyone's saying, oh, they're tactical voting and all this. And I used to get very cross at the telly. But yeah, it did become more kitsch and more camp. And that was fun. But then our music never seemed to get through that. But last year we did, you know. And yet Sam Ryder's music wasn't very camp at all. But I think he had the whole gay community behind him, which was fab.
Yeah. One of the things I always ask in this podcast is about, you know, earliest memories. I think you've answered this already, but what you enjoyed doing as a child. Do you want to say a little bit about where you grew up? Were you in the same, I think you're, is it North Wales that you're from?
North Wales, yeah. I was brought up in Bangor, North Wales, a working class family, terraced house, council estate, and my mum and dad, hard working. My mum was a shoe shop supervisor and my dad worked for Hot Point. And we used to, I had three sisters. I have two biological sisters and a foster sister, and it was fab, actually. I have a great childhood memories. It really, being out on the street, playing with kids in my, you know, who I went to primary school with. I didn't go to the same secondary school, so that's when it sort of like petered off a bit in terms of meeting with around the area. But yeah, we used to have music on. Music was a big thing in my family because we had a record player. And a really interesting thing was that on a Sunday, we'd clean the house as a family and we'd have the music on. So we'd have Grease, you know, and so we own all the album. We always used to take the mickey out my sister because there's Eddie My Love, and she was dating the boy called Eddie. Going, Eddie My Love, Eddie My Love. And she's going, just hilarious. But the irony now, though, is Leo Sayer. We used to listen to, oh, I love Leo Sayer, and I listened to him, and I've always like, you make me feel like dancing, and I loved it. Then he came to Liverpool last November. So for my birthday, I got tickets bought for me. Oh my goodness, it was phenomenal, purely because I knew every single word, and I didn't think I did know everything, but every single song he sang, I knew. And I thought, how the hell? All down to my childhood, all down to cleaning around the house with this record player, my mum and dad singing it, dancing in the kitchen. It was just amazing. Loved it.
No, and you know, you're right, because he became really kind of cool again in, was it like 2006, when they remastered one of his classics, you know, the Thunder in My Heart, and yeah. Suddenly, and that was number one. And it's so funny how suddenly a different generation were suddenly made aware of this fabulous music.
He's 75 or 76, something like that, and he was brilliant. We were in the Philharmonic in Liverpool, and we were in the stalls, and it was just to die for. I loved it. I was one of the youngest people. It was quite weird. It was great. I loved it. And me and my partner just was bopping away. I was astounded at how much I knew of his work. I didn't realize. And that throwback to my mum, my dad, my family, my house, I just loved it. I love his singing.
But I mean, music is a gateway, isn't it, in that sense? And in fact, it's funny, because I always put these little bios up on Facebook sometimes of music that I've been listening to, because I used to record in my uni days a lot of stuff off the radio, and I digitized them. I don't know how I found the time. And I hear something, I think, oh, I must use a snippet of that chorus or something. And I was using the Orchard Road, and you're thinking of When I Need You and all that.
Yeah.
You know, and it's so, I mean, at the time, you know, Leo Sayer went through a period of, he wasn't the most kind of cool kind of guy.
No.
But then he came back in 2006, and you said, and ABBA were the same, because when I was at uni, ABBA were always a bit in the 80s. ABBA would kind of past it a bit. They were sort of like, no, you know, they didn't quite have their mode. And then suddenly, in the, was it late 90s or whenever it was, when the ABBA Mamma Mia musical started, you know, they went catastrophic. It's so funny how that happens.
It is. My daughter loves ABBA, and I'm like, oh my gosh, okay, that's interesting. And it is, yeah, it's how things come full circle, and it is about what triggers how you feel and what triggers memory. I love it. I think music is a really good way to make you remember. My dad, he passed 6 years ago, and around about, and we were a very close family. Loved my dad, but he always used to sing, "Don't worry, be happy," and that was in his funeral. And whenever I'd get a bit anxious, and he'd sing it down the phone or whatever. And I remember going to see Hotel Transylvania 3 in the cinema, and I was fine. I'm watching it, great film, love it. Tara enjoyed it, and then right at the end, they played that. I was bawling my eyes out. I mean, you know, just because it triggers. And it's a nice memory, but it was a sad memory in this amazing cinematic film. And you're thinking, yeah, it's funny how things just floor you.
And I think that's what nostalgia does, because it's, you know, I was sort of trying to work out, because I've been obviously doing this podcast for years, and I'm working on it as part of my job, but it's that sort of bittersweetness, that it's like the past that you've lost. I always think that the nostalgia is not really about the past, it's about the present and the sense of loss, and maybe or something, trying to recapture something that we're missing now, that we feel, whether we did or not is another matter, we feel we once had. And I think you've encapsulated that with what you said about that Bobby McFerrin song.
Well, in Welsh we call it hiraeth, so it means it literally means to the woods, but it means hiraeth, means a nostalgic longing. So I'm hiraeth for home. I'm nostalgic, but it's more than nostalgic. It's like it's palpable. It's physical. I am missing the mountains. I'm hiraeth for my dad. I'm missing, but nostalgic for my dad. You know, hiraeth is a fabulous word to use for that nostalgia.
Yeah, and a friend of mine who was at Lampeter, she did a creative writing course in the 80s.
Yeah.
And she interviewed me. I interviewed her and she interviewed me for this podcast. And she wrote a book on hiraeth. And this is the, and she's American. Now, this is the interesting thing. You'd think, or you might think, oh, you know, she goes to Lampeter every year, et cetera, et cetera. And you say, oh, of course, you must want to move back there. No, absolutely not. It's the thing that makes it work is the fact that you're not, the thing that really matters to you is somewhere from where you stand, in her case, at a very obvious geographical distance. I think she's from the north, the east coast of America, sort of New England area. And mm-hmm. so it's so interesting that sometimes the things that we're drawn to are the things that we know we can't have. And if we had them, we probably would feel ambivalent about it. I mean, I love Lampeter and I go back every year for the reunion, but I know that I could never and should never live there again.
Yeah, I think I had a place, Beth Gallet in North Wales. And I've always been hiraeth for that for years and years and years, because it was my teens and used to go walking and stuff. Apart from not being able to afford to live there, it's far too expensive. I think I would go a bit loopy. There's not enough culture that's alternative, you know? It's very, I don't know, a monolithic identities, really. Although the mountains are beautiful, I think it wouldn't give me so much hiraeth if I lived there. Yeah, in Lampeter, yeah, I only went to Lampeter about four times, but I still had an identity there. It's quite interesting. I got a cracking photograph of my graduation with my shoes, which are like Dorothy shoes, and my hat, and then the beautiful building in the background. I liked Lampeter because of its quirk. It's different, but I went there purely because of Gary, because his research is phenomenal, and yeah. I knew he'd be a very good supervisor.
Yeah, and actually, I'll be seeing Gary and hopefully interviewing him in the summer. So that's that. I can't wait to do that. And being a student there, and I think there's a big difference between being there in the 90s and perhaps being there now. But there was a real kind of, I'm not even, I was about to say subculture. I don't think that's what I mean at all. There was a very loud and proud community of, well, goths is one example. They used to call it Goth Corner, famously in the Student Union bar. But there were a lot of people that, for whom an alternative type existed. I mean, in a way, I didn't fit in. I mean, I fitted in completely, but also not so much for the alternative thing, but a lot of people for whom Lampeter was the place to go because they, you know, the mountains, the environment, it wasn't a city. So people for whom a city would be like the absolute anathema for going to university, and kind of embraced it. And it really worked for a lot of people. And they sort of just fell in love with the fact that they could afford, you know, it was a small place with lots of big people in it. If those big people had gone to a bigger place, they would have been dwarfed.
Yeah. No, I was talking about Beth Gallet, but Lampeter, I think there is a small culture because there's stuff that comes on quite often. Lampeter, I remember talking about the subculture and stuff. It's quite interesting. One day I drove to Lampeter because I was going to do some study there and see my supervisors. So I was working in Edgehill in Liverpool, which is a very, if you think of an American campus, that's what my campus is like at Edgehill. It's massive. It's very plush. It's very modern. It's always regenerating. It's beautiful. And there are lots of different types of people from the Northwest. So Wigan and Liverpool and Preston, etc. But these are nurses, teachers, lawyers, all sorts of learning. Anyway, that day I was traveling, I was walked through the hub, they call it, which is like where all the cafes are. And there was a cheerleading going on, massive cheerleaders. I thought, oh, I didn't know we had a cheerleading team. So it was very much like an American, yay, you know, whoop, whoop. And then I drove all the way to Lampeter, and the juxtaposition was I saw jousting. So I saw students in one university being cheered as cheerleaders and jocks. And then I went to another one, which is only 4 hours away in Wales, that's in a remote area, that was jousting and medieval with swords. I thought, oh, my goodness, that's phenomenal. Love it. It was so summarised the culture of that community and that university, because Lampeter is very quirky, very historical, and has interesting students that are alternative, shall we say.
And
Edgehill aren't necessarily like that.
Do you know, it's funny because when the Dungeons and Dragons film came out just a few weeks ago, I went to see it. And actually, the fact, and Hugh Grant, who clearly did it because his agent told him, and he was clearly, he'd never played it and thought it was a bit odd that, you know, what he had no idea why, what he was even doing in the film, I don't think. And I thought, well, I'm curious to see him in that. And suddenly all these friends of mine, both school and university, you talk about coming out of the broom closet, but people who came out and maybe they were, maybe there was never a closet as it were, because, you know, maybe I just didn't see it because it wasn't my sort of thing at all. But there were all these like Dungeons and Dragons clubs that people we used to be involved with in the early 90s, in the, you know, when I was at school. And I was like reading all these posts and I just thought, I had no idea. This was all going on around me. And you're right, Lampeter completely embrace that kind of alternative kind of.
I love Dungeons and Dragons. I've never played it, but I remember my first, in the 80s, there was a cartoon called Dungeons and Dragons. I loved this cartoon. It was all about the whole game, but cartoon wise. And then I remember I worked in Halfords as a shop assistant, and the two managers were what, in their young 20s, and they were living in a place called Gearman, which was on Anglesey. And I can't remember why. But I popped into their house one time with some friends. Can't remember. I think it was a party. But there was a Dungeons and Dragons board out and they actively played Dungeons and Dragons. I thought, oh my gosh, this is so interesting. I mean, this was before the internet. Nowadays, you'd be on the internet, wouldn't you? But it was really interesting. I didn't see this dimension because they were two very sensible managers of Halfords, big shop in Bangor. But actually at night, they'd go home and play this board game.
Yeah, actually, and you just reminded me, because when I saw the film, I saw it sort of about 9:30 in the evening, and the chap who came over said, oh, are you looking forward to this? And I was like, you know, yeah, so. And he said that they have a Dungeons and Dragons club in the cinema, and they'd be, you know, not just because the film had, I mean, maybe that had sort of rekindled it, I suppose, but they were talking about how, you know, all the staff, they were doing this. And it's kind of lovely, really, because, you know, in a way, a lot of that passed me by. But I sort of look back and it makes me think differently about the people I went to school with. Maybe not differently. It makes a lot more sense now, and I kind of get it. Whereas at the time, I don't think I would have seen what was in front of me, to be honest.
I would have liked to have done that, I think. I'm that sort of person. I would have completely immersed myself into the role play. I would have loved it, but I never did it. I never did Dungeons and Dragons. I liked the idea of it, but I think my imagination is so extreme that I would have felt it was real. And I suppose that's why I liked Second Life, because there's Dungeons and Dragons and different dress up and different roles that you play in that. And yeah, I think I would have really enjoyed that in the 90s, but I never had anyone who talked about it or played about it, apart from the Halfords people, but they were my best.
And I've got to ask, because you did, was it religious studies at university?
Theology and Religious Studies, yeah, with primary education.
Where did you do that?
Chester.
Oh, yeah. So, I mean, obviously, it's easy now to look back and see the thread, you know, in terms of the work that you're doing now, the work on witchcraft, and of course, how I met you through that TV program when we interviewed you and your daughter. But and maybe it's easy to look back and say, oh, there's a pattern, and it was, you're obviously destined to do all these things. But what were your motives for doing it in the first place?
Oh, right. Well, my education background, mum always said, get an education so you don't have to rely on a man. So that's what we did. Three girls, you know, we have to make sure that we are self-sufficient. Because my mum struggled and my dad was a fabulous man and a fabulous provider, a fabulous dad. But, you know, money's always been hard. So mum was never allowed to have her education. So she encouraged us to do an education and she supported us all the way. So both me and my sisters have a good education and good jobs. But when I was 15, I was in school and I was Roman Catholic. And when I was even younger than that, we were always told to go to church on a Sunday and be a good Catholic. Went to primary school, that was a Catholic school. And I remember lying in bed when I was about 8 or 9 and wanting to get up. And it was early for everyone else. And I wanted to get up to watch Bagpuss. And I thought, oh, if I get up and watch Bagpuss, mum's going to send me to church. If I don't, then I miss Bagpuss, but then I'm going to have to clean with Leo Sayer, you know. So that was the choice. So religion's always been part of it. And then in my teens, I wanted to question, why do people stand up and sit down? Why are we standing up for church and sit down? Why do we kneel up all the time in Catholicism? Why do we do this? So I started questioning it and looking at different types of Christianity and asking questions. And then I decided then that I needed to do it for A-level to find out, why do people stand up and sit down? And I remember one time studying for A-level and some Jehovah's Witnesses came to the door and I stood there for an hour chatting to them. My mum came and grabbed me and said, "We're all Roman Catholic here, go away." And I said, "All I'm doing is finding out." And she said, "No, you're not, because they'll try and convert you." So I thought, really? So then I decided to do it for degree to still find out who am I and where do I fit in this religious part. And I came across the word pluralist, which was amazing. And I realized, oh, that's what I am. I've got a label. I'm now a pluralist, which means all these different ways are acceptable. And I decided to study it for undergraduate. But the modules I chose were very safe. It was theology and religious studies, but I chose modules that I felt comfortable with rather than pushing myself. So I should have looked at the Upanishads and I didn't, because I didn't really know what they were. I just looked at Old Testament and Johannine studies. But we did do iconography, and I loved this module. And that started opening my ideas about different ways of expressing spirituality. So I finished that degree, but it was a teacher training degree. So I came out with a qualification. And the reason I went for teacher training was because my mum said, you can always earn money as a teacher. I wanted to go on the stage, to be honest. I wanted to be an actor. And she said, go and do that. So I did. And then I went to London, and that's when it blossomed. And then I decided a couple of years in, I really enjoyed teaching. It was great. But I wanted to see if I could do more. And I saw a religious education master's, and I thought, I'm going to see if I can do that. Because I was quite quiet, believe it or not, in my 20s and in uni. My uni, like we're talking about destiny, most of my uni was about counselling a friend. She was very, very unhappy, suicidal often, and self-harming. And I would sometimes sacrifice my studies to support her. And in our final year, it was a four-year degree, her dad died. And so I supported her with that as well. And so I thought, I wonder if I could actually get a better degree classification. Can I do a master's? So I went, and on my first day, I thought, I'm not going to say a word. It was part-time. Well, I couldn't stop talking. It was amazing. And Ruth Ann Lenger was my supervisor, was my tutor. She was phenomenal, course lead. And she just gave me a platform to talk. She offered me some guest lecturing, saw my potential that I didn't see. And then I blossomed. And that was then looked at. That's when I started looking at alternate ways of looking at faith. So spirituality module was amazing. And children's spirituality as well. It was really interesting. And then, like I said, over the years, I just dabbled in witchcraft myself without calling it witchcraft. And then when I came to my PhD, I thought, well, I'm going to be stubborn and do it on something I like, so I'll keep going with it. And then the witchcraft pagan witch was natural progression, really. But I think I've already, or on a personal level, had a theme of witches throughout. So I was born around Halloween, had Halloween parties, dabbled in candle magic, which was a thing that was about meditation in my teens and my 20s, tarot in my 20s. Tried to go back to the church in my 30s because I was with a lad who I married, and not with him anymore, and he was Roman Catholic. So I thought, oh, I'm going to go to church, and I realized I wanted community. So I was a reader. I tried to do a lot with the church, but it still didn't sit with me because I still did the tarot, and I still did, you know, dowsing and sort of magic stuff and blessing the house and buying witchcraft books and stuff. And then in my 40s, that's when I sort of like came out properly.
Yeah. It's interesting, isn't it? Because I used to go to my local parish church in Cardiff, and I used to be involved. I suppose they were very keen for people. Looking back, it's easy to see that they want the younger generation, obviously, to be involved, because, you know, when I often get, I'm sure it's similar to yourself over the years, you get asked to go to church groups or to, you know, and you find that they're all like over 70, and you realize that there's no one younger or very few people younger. So of course they need people of a younger age in order to help kind of ensure that there's continuity and survival. But what I used to do, I used to go to the church, and I never really understood what was going on, in the sense of doing a degree answered all of those questions for me. And I could ask the sort of questions that I couldn't ask my parish priest and so on. And I'd go and, you know, there's all the rituals and, you know, standing up, sitting down, saying the things out loud. I never really understood why I was saying the things I was saying. But, and this is my confession, I'd be there thinking, it was a Sunday morning about 11 o'clock, and I'd be thinking 6 hours till Bruno Brooks starts reading out the charts on Radio 1. And that was the thing I had done. That was what Sundays were for me. So it's the whole secular and the sacred. But let's be honest, the sacred and the secular were reversed and commingled, you know, even in those days. For me, yeah. 5 o'clock on a Sunday was my sacred time.
Yeah, mine was Sunday dinner. I couldn't wait to go home for mum's roast potatoes. Lovely. Yeah. Do you know, it's really interesting, though. Recently, like I said earlier, I went to Westminster Cathedral recently when I was in London. And I went with my sister, which was lovely. We had a couple of days together. And there happened to be at 12 o'clock, so there was a service. And my sister, I'd gone to the nip to the loo, came back, and she was sitting there ready for the service. I went, okay, let's sit down. Well, it was so interesting because I remembered every single word, because it's high Anglican, so it's like Catholicism in terms of the responses. And I didn't have to read it. I remembered it. And I thought, gosh, it's interesting how things stay in your psyche. I haven't been to a mass for about 5 years, and I like the community. I love the atmosphere, the ritual, but I don't necessarily believe, and I won't go for bread and I won't go for a blessing because I'm a witch. I also find that quite ironic that I'm in a church and I'm a witch. But it's interesting, it stays in your psyche, even though you've now rejected it, it's still there. You know it because it's part of your upbringing. It's part of your culture. And I think blending culture with religion and sacred and secular is part of the norm nowadays. It's what we do. We have our own types of rituals that we do because as humans, that's what we need to do. You see that with shrines on the side of the road and stuff, don't you?
Yeah. And also even my students, because obviously we don't have as many students now as perhaps we did a decade ago. And that's a really big issue in arts and humanities. And we're feeling the pinch at Kent. But the students who do the degree always sort of enjoy, like, I do a religion and film course. But you think when I was a student, an undergraduate, we didn't have those sort of courses on offer. But actually, I look back and I don't regret that, because I think, well, in a way, I was able to sort of pioneer that kind of thing. But it is interesting that there were those more sort of traditional roots, which I also think you need as the basis. I mean, you know, you're doing obviously brilliant work in paganism, witchcraft, et cetera, but the fact that you've got a background in a sort of more traditional sort of thing means at least you've got the background and the parameters and you know how to shape it. Because if you were to go in to do what you're doing now, then in a way you'd probably, all your enthusiasm would be there, but you wouldn't have the same sort of ballast, the same sort of, you know, able to sort of take the bits that you need and go with it. So I kind of feel that I needed that traditional background in order to not hijack it necessarily, but sort of move it in the direction that I have in the last few decades.
I think so, to a point. I think my degree was very traditional, but then we had some others, like there was this fantastic module like iconography, loved it, which is traditional, but also not. It was unconventional in some ways. And also we had one which was about Melanesian traditional religions, which was looking at indigenous traditions and cultures. And I loved that. And they're the two that stuck with me. So now the course that I deliver, my BA in religion, I've made it contemporary. So we have some of the, because you need some of the theology. So we look at it, some of the basics of what is Christianity, what is Judaism, what is Sikhism, etc., for Abrahamics and Dharmic religions. But then we look at modules that explore contemporary. So we look at religion in the public sphere. So film, music, art, theatre, and we go to museums to look at the sacred. So there's a fantastic World Museum in Liverpool that has cadavers, and the cadavers are Egyptian mummies, but they are real cadavers and people, you know, they're real human remains. And when I take my students and I say, I want you to consider the concept of sacred, and I want you to think about what's secular sacred, what's religious sacred, and what is social sacred, and how do we balance that as humans? Because these mummies are phenomenal, and of course they're sacred and they're kept safe so that we can learn. But actually that person, that 21-year-old person who's lying in that sarcophagus there, didn't intend to be in a glass case, intended to be actually buried and gone to the afterlife. And that's a really interesting conversation that we have. And I think that's where we should be moving religious studies into, how it's lived, how we question society. We also have one which is called Body and Religion. So we look at the embodiment of the divine and how your body is used in faith in lots of different ways. So we look at indigenous communities as well as, you know, Catholicism and the host and all that sort of stuff. And I think that nowadays we need to blend the two to make our faith, our subject of religion, meaningful and continue it throughout the future curriculums, we need to make sure that students, children can see its relevance, because it's in everything.
Yeah.
And it's spirituality, sacred, religion, but religion is a bad word, dirty name nowadays. And I think that's a shame, because it's about faith and belief.
Yeah. Yeah. And you're right. And also, I'm hoping that with all the TV stuff that we're doing, which obviously is for younger people, that mm-hmm. maybe that will help change. I mean, it's maybe a tall order to imagine that a TV program is suddenly going to change everyone's perceptions, but it's going to help in that regard in terms of the content and the fact that we're talking about religion, but we're doing it in a way that feels that we're meeting the students where they are, the pupils where they are, rather than imposing it from the point of view of, you know, somebody like, well, our age, let's be honest, you know, yeah. who, you know, one of my daughters actually said the other day, she said, I don't want to be rude, daddy, but, you know, why are 11 to 15 year olds going to be interested in somebody presenting a program when they're, who's 50? But the key thing is we have lots of younger presenters, co-presenters and so on. But that kind of hits the nail on the head.
True, totally. Because, you know, we're not cool. Yeah. We're out of time. I think we're cool, but
yeah, you, it's funny, isn't it? Sometimes when you've got children, mine range between 8 and 11, and you mm-hmm. suddenly realise that you just can't compete anymore. You know, in the cool stakes, no.
Oh, do you know,
that coach passed decades ago.
Oh yeah, I've had you're so embarrassing, it's so many times. But we've got a friend coming over this weekend, and Tara says, "Oh, my friend's really looking forward to meeting you." Oh, great, okay, yeah, she thinks you're cool. I went, really? How come? You normally think I'm not. And she goes, well, I just told her a few things. I thought, okay, so deep down, I won't unpick that one. I'll take that one. Yeah. That's a win for one day.
Well, I've got to, as we start to wrap up, Maggie, I'm just thinking here about, as you look back on your life and career, I mean, this sort of concept of nostalgia, of course, sort of, you know, is something that we've been talking about. But would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones?
Always. I think my, even when things haven't gone right, I've always learned from it, and it's been for a reason. So if I haven't got the job that I wanted, it's been because something better came along later. Or if I had one role that I found really challenging, and I felt stifled, but I had to learn from that and learn patience and resilience to be able to then be better at what I do now. So I've loved every career path and every opportunity. I've always, when I was a teenager, there was Philip Larkin is what I studied for A-level. And there's this poem called As Bad as a Mile. And it's basically about the person holding an apple and trying to hit it, eating it and throwing it to a basket and missing. And so they're so scared of missing the basket that they don't even bite the apple. And that resonated with me at 18, because I thought, oh my goodness, they are so scared of failing that you don't even try the juicy apple. I'm never going to do that ever again. And it's about having a growth mindset. So I used to be scared of it. Now I go, oh, I'm afraid, but I'm going to play with a fear. I'm scared of it not going well. I'm scared of being silly. I'm scared of it going wrong, but I'm going to try anyway, because otherwise I might miss an opportunity. So because I've had that mindset, I've tried lots of different things, and I've been really fortunate with all the different experiences that I've had. That's made me the person I am and the academic I am now, I think.
Absolutely. And you've actually answered the next question, which was whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. Because I would say the same thing as you, that sometimes even if things didn't work out, and you know, we've all had challenges of one kind or another. But I guess I suppose this is the thing, that sometimes it feels like, oh, we've survived. You know, we've got to a point where we're kind of doing the things that maybe we wanted to do. But if it hadn't been for some of those knocks along the way, maybe we wouldn't be here.
Yeah, and that's what we're supposed to do, isn't it? We're supposed to learn. We don't have everything in the bag. And I think it makes you a better, more resilient person if things go wrong. It's not always nice, but it happens. I mean, sometimes it's very embarrassing, but you know, you live, you still survive. So carry on.
And you mentioned that you, for example, you worked in Halfords when you were young, and your dad worked for Hotpoint and so on. But what did your younger self think that you would end up doing? Did you imagine that you'd be in this academic?
No, I was below average. I still say I am, but my sister said, no, you're Maggie, you've got a PhD, you're a high achiever. Am I? Okay. But no, I was, if it was today's education system, I'd have been in the lower ability classes. I think I'm dyslexic. I would have had trouble. But I came to my own slow and steady. I believe that everyone reaches their own development stage. So when I was, in my teens, I was in the pantomime. So I used to dance in the pantomime every year in Theatre Gwynedd, and then which isn't there anymore. And I became Cinderella at 18, and I wanted to go to the theatre, but we had to earn money. And mum was realistic, and so was I. I can do it amateur dramatics if I want to, but I never went back. So I think I would have wanted to be that, but a teacher was a good net. At 15, I decided to be a teacher because I knew that it was a good job. I would be good at it. I'm good with kids, and I can help people not feel as if they're stupid. And that just blossomed. And then what's happened over the years is that my purpose in life has been to. I've had so many people throughout my life since I would say since I was about 12. People come in my life who are a little bit lost, and they've needed someone to go, okay, let me see. All right, and put them in the right direction, you know? And I do that a lot in my job now. And I think that's what I've been here for. So I was destined to be in a position where I can help influence and be part of someone's life in a positive way and their career journey. And I wouldn't have done that if I was on the stage.
Although, I mean, that's really inspiring, but there's another thing as well, which is in a way you are doing both, because because it's obvious that
Oh,
the performing element,
yeah.
you've I mean, same with me. I wanted to be on the radio. I wanted to be Bruno Brooks doing the charts, you know, when I was so on, and still do, if I'm honest. And yet I kind of am doing that.
The big lecture theatres, I've lectured in front of 300, 400 people. Doesn't bother me. I think it's good. You put on a show, don't you? And I'm quite quirky. I don't mind that. But like you, I see people on telly go, I want to do that. So, you know, there's some people who are presenting on TV programs. I'm thinking, yeah, okay. You know, I'd like to, I'd look, they've got my job. And I think sometimes, you know, we can still dream, can't we? And do things that want us to be a little bit different.
Well, I've got one more question to ask you. Would you consider yourself, Maggie, to be a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
Oh, that's a good question. I'm not quite sure. I think I'm a looking now person, and I look now because I believe that, oh, we've got this very minute. I mean, you know, now anything could happen in the next 30 seconds. All I know is now. But to get to now, I need to remember who I was and how I've got to now. And I need to think about who I want to be later. It's not what I want to be, but who, the sort of person I want to be when I'm 60, when I'm 70, when I'm 80 or 90 if I get to it. What sort of person do I want to be, and how can I do that? So I do things like I'll. It's not, I don't like the 5-year plan business, but I do think a little bit about where I would like to be or who I'd like to be and what I'd still like to be doing. But I'm certainly in the moment here now.
Well, I think that's a perfect way to end. Very, very wise words. Maggie, thank you so much for being my guest this week.
Thank you. Thank you very much for inviting me, Chris. Take care.